Hi, everybody. Welcome to Blockbusting, the podcast where we love to hate movies. I'm your host, Jay Light. Joining me today, Rama Valuri.
Hey, Jay.
Hi, Rama. So nice to have you. I'm very excited to talk about this movie with you because I haven't seen this movie in years. I can't really remember, like, why. I think I watched it just to be like a cool teen whenever I was, I think it was one of the first R-rated movies I saw of my own volition that I didn't have to get parental approval to watch.
Right.
I grew up super sheltered and I wasn't allowed to, I had to get everything approved, but this one, I remember pulling it. I was like, yeah, I have to get you guys to approve what I get at Blockbuster. Oh my God. Anyway, Rama, you wanted to talk about American Beauty.
I didn't want to talk about American Beauty. I've tried to forget American Beauty since I first saw it, and then I was asked to do this podcast. And right away, when I was asked what movie I don't like, without hesitation, this popped right to the front of my mind. Like, that's the one. That is the one.
It's... sounds like you've had a pretty visceral reaction to this the first time you watched it, the kind of like indelible reaction that I haven't heard somebody have to a movie in quite a while. So like, why after all this time has this stuck with you?
I had the profound feeling at the end of watching that movie that I wanted the time back that I spent watching the movie, that I spent seeing trailers, that I spent hearing people talk about the movie, that it became so big in the zeitgeist at the time, and every interview show had Spacey or Annette Bening on it. Every award show got dominated by it. And personally, I thought other movies that year were just better in almost every conceivable way. And that I was expected to like this movie because you're told this is a stunning achievement. It's amazing. If you don't like it, you're wrong. And then I watched it and went, ah, this is one of those movies that everyone decides if you don't like it, you're wrong. But if you ask them what they like about it, they're hard pressed to put their finger on it going, you know, it was just kind of the whole thing. It just was. It was an experience.
It works all together, you know.
You can't look at one individual piece and really judge the movie by it. Like if you didn't like Kevin Spacey, there's something else in it for you. Like no. the only thing that really stuck with me that I went, oh, okay, this was really well done, was Chris Cooper was fantastic in the part that he was playing in it, and
yes.
It looks pretty, so points to Sam Mendes for how he directed it. But it felt to me like a very self-important piece of community theater with a bigger budget, but most of the movie and the experience of it, it just felt like the most self-congratulatory and masturbatory piece of art to come out that year of the screenwriter, everybody. And it felt so blah, I think is the best term. And I thought maybe it was just the time, just this movie. And I understand it doesn't work for me. It works for a lot of people. So if you love it, good for you. I'm not one of you. I thought maybe it was just this movie. But then I watched 6 Feet Under because a friend of mine said, hey, can you watch this? Because I want someone to talk about with this. So I watched 6 Feet Under. And that show, I had the exact same reaction of I wanted my time back so much by the end of it, where it just really highlighted that maybe Alan Ball isn't for me. Maybe his style doesn't work for me.
It could very well be that. I haven't watched a whole lot of, I don't think actually I've seen any other Alan Ball work that comes to mind, at least. I remember watching this for the first time. I was talking to you a little bit about this before we started recording, mm-hmm. but like the first time I watched it, I was definitely like either like, for, you know, on the cusp of being out of high school or just out of high school. And I was starting to really get into like, oh, there's other movies. There's like, you know, some art house kind of stuff. And I had some of those movies really like leave an impact on me. And I was like, well, this is one of the sort of, I guess, the original like widespread art house films. I should check it out. And I remember watching it and I was like, okay, I guess I get it. And watching it again now, I couldn't help but think almost the entire time that sure, this movie might have set a bar in terms of like, you know, we're doing films about the art house style, where it's like, okay, this is an accessible art house movie, you know, directed by a well-regarded theater director in his directorial debut, and, you know, domestic drama, very, very heightened, very melodramatic at times, but also having like this weird undercurrent of realism that doesn't really like, it doesn't seem like a kind of movie that a lot of people who watched this movie would have seen before. But watching it now, I can't help but think, oh, this movie has been done way better so mm-hmm. many times since this.
Yeah. And even before it, I thought going in that I would get something like Ordinary People, which the Redford movie from.
See, I've never seen Ordinary People.
So that, when I looked at that, it was like,
tell me about it.
That I thought was a more important, might be a way to say it, or a more accurate portrayal of that suburban malaise. But it was, that was built around tragedy, and it was a quiet movie, in that way of the story carried it and the performances carried it, and it was all very harmonious the way that came together. A lot about this movie felt disjointed in the way, however it was that they decided to present it, was just so thumb in your eye. Hey, do you see what I'm showing you? Do you see what the suburbs are like? Do you see what people are like when they've hit their midlife crisis? Do you see what people just around the neighborhood are like? Wow, they live in your neighborhood too. I bet you didn't think about this. I thought about it though. No one's ever thought about it the way that I did. Look at how pretty I made it.
Look what I did.
Yeah. It wasn't bluff. They weren't holding anything back. There wasn't any mechanism that they didn't pull. And even, I'm a voiceover guy, so when voiceover is done really well, I appreciate it. And the device that they were using was the same that Billy Wilder used in Sunset Boulevard, of the dead protagonist telling his story. Mm-hmm. And there was something about it that, at the time, Kevin Spacey's on this big high, everybody's paying attention to him, fresh off of things. Well, Usual Suspects, what came out a couple of years before that?
It was 5 years before that, I think. Yeah. The crazy thing, I didn't even know this. Mm-hmm. Originally, the studio did not want Kevin Spacey to be the lead because they didn't think he was well known enough. Even after winning an Oscar for Usual Suspects.
Pretty much everything from Usual Suspects on. So it's like, at the time, I really liked his work. Mainly, I liked watching him get ripped to pieces by Jack Lemmon and Al Pacino and Glengarry Glen Ross. So I was like, oh, okay, he's very talented. I like what he does. Let's watch mm-hmm. this. And that movie, the whole time I watched it, American Beauty, went, I have zero sympathy for you. I don't root for this protagonist at all. I don't find you particularly interesting. I don't find you charming. I don't find anything about you appealing. So I don't care that by the end you're dead. And dude, really the lingering thing was, he's such a goddamn creep in it. And it's borne out perhaps now that maybe that's more accurate to who he is as a person than just the character he was playing.
Sort of a Chris D'Elia and you situation
way
earlier on.
Way earlier than you thought. And I remember
also
watching
with teen girls instead of teen boys.
Yep.
That's the major difference here.
Yeah, there's the big difference
after
a teen girl.
Yeah, Ricky Fitz.
Right. Yeah, so while watching this, I didn't care about anybody in it. I didn't find them interesting, apart from Chris Cooper's character, because of the way he played it was so raw and vulnerable. I went, okay, this is interesting. Everybody else was so big, so theater. I watched the I Rule scene right before we jumped onto this, just to get back into my mind a scene that I remember watching and going, oh my God. Just the pacing of it, it's awkward, it's disjointed, it's not Howard Hawks yet, it's a kind of Howard Hawks. So
kind of.
A lot of this movie, to your point, where it said, okay, this is an art house movie that was more designed for a wider audience. I'm like, oh, it's an attempt at making a blockbuster art house movie.
Right.
Intentionally. So you didn't go far enough to make it pure art house, and you didn't go far enough to just make it your normal melodrama. Your cats are agreeing with
me. My cats are freaking out right now.
What's, you guys, calm down. All right. You, over here. I'm going to keep all this in.
Yeah, you should.
All of this in, because we need to have the explanation. What's going on? All right. Time out. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, we're talking about melodrama, and the cats start acting melodramatic.
That was like the dinner scene. They were just yelling for no reason.
No reason at all. Just here we are. I don't know. I think I really do feel that the cats agreed with
us.
They
100% agree. I think that part of the problem I had with this movie this time around that I didn't notice before is that the dialogue, none of it sounds like anything that any human being would actually say for like 80% of the movie.
Yeah.
All of the melodramatic stuff just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because it's not played as a straight melodrama the whole time. If they had kept out the realism with Chris Cooper and his son. Oh God, what's his son's name? Wes Bentley.
Wes Bentley, yeah.
Who I do think, and Thor Birch even to some degree, mm-hmm. I think that if they had kept the focus more on them and allowed the rest of the story to be told through that lens instead of this weird, hyper, melodramatic version of Kevin Spacey and Annette Bening and Mina Suvari, if as simple of a shift as that, that would have allowed this movie to do so much better. Because I think there's a lot of the, you know, a lot of the directorial and cinematography choices I really liked. I think there were some really, like, really stunning shots. And it's very clear that, you know, Sam Mendes is trying to act as at his best powers here of like, all right, you know, even the placement of light in the frame and the way that stuff is set up. And again, there's a reason why I think the cinematography and the direction won at the Academy Awards. But the screenplay, I don't get it. I don't understand why everybody was giving Alan Ball heaps and heaps of praise for this movie when being John Malkovich and Magnolia and The Sixth Sense were also all nominated for Best Original Screenplay that year.
Yeah, there's so many movies from 99, which I think this year was a really, really great year for movies. And over time, it's borne out that movies like The Insider have much more of an impact, or Sixth Sense prior to a lot of the parodying people have done of M. Night Shyamalan's work.
Right.
Or even, but I personally, and I know this probably informs part of my opinion on this, I'm a big fan of Denzel Washington. And I loved The Hurricane as a kid watching that. Everything that he did in that movie. And then later, going back and looking at performances like Russell Crowe in The Insider or anybody else that year.
Yeah.
And I remember when when Kevin Spacey walked up during the Oscars to get the Oscar, I just was like, all I could think of was, you guys really hate Denzel Washington, don't you? Because he wasn't about going on all the talk shows and campaigning
right
for the awards. Like, you really hate that he doesn't want to do this.
He doesn't play the game. Yeah, I remember you were saying stuff, because I didn't watch the Oscars at this point in time, mm-hmm. but I do remember you were saying some stuff about his Oscar speech. What was he saying in his speech?
Oh, we love him because he's imperfect, sort of thing. Like, Spacey was defending the character of Lester in a way that very much seemed to be that D'Elia in You or Spacey as time has gone out. It's like... Mm-hmm. Talking about himself, he's like, everyone loves me because I'm imperfect, kind of deal.
Right.
It was, I didn't love the character. That only made me get angrier while watching. I was like, I didn't love him because he was imperfect. I thought he was a piece of shit the whole way through.
He's a whole piece of shit, man.
And maybe he's a piece of shit who gets into better shape by the end, yes. physically from exercising, but. He and his wife, they have a shithole of a marriage that's falling apart, mm-hmm. and he's lusting after the teen girl next door kind of thing. And like, nothing about it. I didn't feel anything for him when Lester died.
It
was
no.
like, yeah. good, fine.
He deserved it.
You deserve all of this because... You're a horrible creep who shouldn't be around.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing really, really stuck with me, of him winning it. And it like, what, a year before was when Saving Private Ryan got screwed out of it for Shakespeare in Love.
Right.
Which is another case of I think was the first time while watching the Oscars as a kid that I really had it sink in for me how pointless most award shows are. Because I would go back, and being a huge music fan, I would look at what the Grammys gave awards to in favor of other things, or what didn't get nominated for a year. I went, oh, okay,
right.
So the Grammys were started by Sinatra and folks like that who wanted to protect real music, so their kind of music. So a lot of rock and roll in the 60s didn't get any attention at all, or 50s.
Of course.
It's inherently a racist institution that they've been trying to fix. I went, okay, so that's for the Grammys, but the Oscars, that's the big prestigious American awards show. They must have gotten this right, because you always look at it, oh, it's Academy Award winner, best picture, whatever year. This must be the best movie of that year.
Right.
And with Saving Private Ryan in particular, I went, oh, it's never, that's not true every year that the best movie wins. Also, how does one judge art against art? But besides that, it's like, okay, if you're just accepting we're judging these things, what is better, what has a longer impact, and what just happens to have energy of the moment or momentum because the press has decided that this is the most interesting movie, or
because they've had enough money thrown at them by the campaigners
yeah.
to decide that this is, like, the most interesting.
What was
movie.
It, a year ago or something, when that Emily in Paris thing for Netflix, they flew people to France?
Oh, for the Golden
France.
Globes.
Yeah, for the Golden Globes.
I mean, the Golden Globes is a whole other can of
fucking
pseudo. Yeah,
it's like, give them a trip to Paris and a bunch of crap, and then, okay, yeah, you'll win some things.
Weird insider, whatever. What's the money version of nepotism? I forget the name of it. I know there's a
payola?
Name for it. A payola, yeah, or yeah. like quid pro quo kind
quid
of bullshit.
Pro, yeah.
This is the kind of thing, and this is the opposite version of it, right? Where I think mm-hmm. that, like, you know, the Academy Awards, I think, have a little bit more cachet in mm-hmm. terms of not being so overtly bought and paid for the way that the Golden Globes are.
Sure.
Because the Oscars, you still have plenty of room for surprises with,
yeah.
with, you know, I mean, look at a couple years back mm-hmm. when Parasite, of course, took everybody by surprise.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, people who were like me and you, who are cynical mm-hmm. of the awards show scene, who are like, yeah, there's no way.
Yeah, it's like, there's no way they're going to do it. And then they did it. It was like, whoa, they got it right?
That's crazy, man.
Holy cow.
Oh, my God. And but the beauty of that is that's the real American beauty right there. That's mm-hmm.
the tagline
for this.
The real American.
But that's the thing. It's like, I think that if you want to do what this movie is attempting to do and sort of succeeding, mm-hmm. I think that the other big problem that I at least would change is that if you're going to try and tell people in the suburbs, hey, your lives are empty and it's okay to like accept that your lives are empty.
Mm-hmm.
There's better ways to do it than having everything be melodramatic. I think,
right.
And part of that melodrama is certainly not helped by the fact that you have like these sort of angsty know-it-all teens mm-hmm. who are also, you know, they're like, you know how kids in sitcoms always are like the smartest version mm-hmm. or even in movies, you know, like rom-coms, it's a classic trope where like the kid is smarter than all the adults.
Right.
This movie has that sort of thing, but it's got the like the kids feel the ennui of their daily lives and they understand that. And the parents they're not lashing out at it the way their parents are.
Right.
But I think if you had the framing told from the point of view of primarily the Fitz family and you got to see that version of mundanity as mm-hmm. opposed to what the Burnham family is, which is super heightened, super chaotic.
Yeah.
And altogether feels more unrealistic and mm-hmm. and as such, I don't think works as a criticism of what the film is trying to critique.
Right.
Of that lifestyle, of that emptiness. It doesn't really work.
I think you're absolutely right that the Fitz family is by far the more interesting family
yeah.
in that neighborhood. And if you spent the time that you did with the Burnhams with them instead, you'd have a much stronger critique of American life or suburban American life, of prejudice, mm-hmm. of ennui and everything. But even within the same year, Magnolia may not be the best Paul Thomas Anderson movie, may not be the favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie, but it addressed some of the same things that
right.
that this did, and I think in a much better way, even in that case being a little heavy-handed too. But there's just so much in this, and when you bring up the kids, I know it's been done to death and parodied to the point of absurdum, but the goddamn plastic bag and the wind thing scene. That if you're commenting on, even let's just say this kid thinking that he's so much smarter than everybody and he's seeing the hidden beauty in the day-to-day, in the mundane, he can spot it in something as simple as a plastic bag floating in the wind, and that captivates her. As ridiculous and hackneyed as that is, even if they're claiming that they're critiquing it, they linger on it so much that the two big visuals that stay with you from this movie are Kevin Spacey's creepy dream with the rose petals and this goddamn plastic bag in
plastic
the wind.
Bag, man.
Which and every this- show, like Family Guy, I remember, did a parody of it and went the exact same length as the movie did mm-hmm. with the plastic bag. And when they did it, it was so much funnier because I went, you're not going to go the full. Oh, wait, you are going to go the full. You're really committing to this. You are going to do the entire scene. It's like, oh, good. If it gave us nothing else, this movie gave us Seth MacFarlane making fun of it, which is
right.
an enjoyable experience in there. But that was the big thing of watching that going, there are a million film school kids who are watching this right now and obsessing over this. And I always feel like when I'm at a movie, particularly art films, I remember when I saw, I gotta remember the name of this, the Boots Riley movie.
Sorry to Bother You.
So I was living in like Koreatown, a transformer blew up in the neighborhood, so we all lost power, and it was 119 degrees.
Oh, God.
And I couldn't stay in our place because I was suffocating. So I just went walking around and walked over to the Dome and the Arclight in Hollywood, just as many miles as it took to get there, because like they have air conditioning. It was midnight, and I watched Sorry to Bother You, which I had planned on seeing anyway. and I had the best time watching that movie. And 2 minutes after I walk out of the theater, there's a couple behind me in the stereotypical Silver Lake uniform of
right.
of Sperry and Ness topsiders and super thick frame glasses with fake lenses in them. And the guy in this couple, he just went, yeah, you know, I thought it was really an interesting film, but it's hardly Truffaut. And he started right away. And I'm walking out of this going, this is like a broadside to everything. And this guy, 2 minutes after, it doesn't give time for the movie to sink in or the messages of the movie to sink in. And then he proceeds to give presumably his girlfriend or his friend who was with him, a dissertation on why he did not like that movie 2 minutes after The House Lights came on.
It's insane to have that kind of a
critique. This came out yesterday. Did you go yesterday and then bring this person with you so that you could sound like the smartest guy in the coffee shop? And that particular guy, I think, loves American Beauty and may have
for sure.
that poster up in his house, may have the screenplay book, and would tell me that I simply don't get it. And
right.
maybe he's right in that way. Maybe that movie was made for him or people like him. But this, it raises my ire so much. And usually I try and find something. I was like, well, okay, there's something about this that lingers, that is good, that it's not terrible. Because I love watching schlock movies. And one of the reasons I love watching schlock movies is they go for it. They 100% go for it every time. And this one of the biggest crimes it has is that it doesn't go far enough in one direction or the other. And that just ends up leaving me with this feeling that I wasted all of my time. And then to know that I watched 6 Feet Under years later and had that same sensation over what 6 seasons of watching that, and it was only because my friend wanted me to see it. I feel like Alan Ball owes me that time of my life back, which I will never get. But I again, that's it may just be his style, his forms of expression, the stories that he wants to tell. I don't find particularly interesting for me.
I can imagine that I probably would not like other Alan Ball work. And hey, to both of our credits, now the film has basically turned, has become one of the most overrated movies of all time. And there
oh,
are
good.
It has been, I mean, in 2005, Premiere Magazine named it as one of the most 20 most overrated movies of all time. Sam Mendes in 2008 even said, yeah, I think it was a little overpraised. I think some of that is entirely justified. But the crazy thing is that, like, even at the time, so many people gave this movie the highest amount of praise. They're like, this is genius. Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars, 2 thumbs up. You know, they're all saying terrific. A lot of stuff about, like, Kevin Spacey's performance, you know, witty and agile and imbues Lester with genuine feeling. And I just don't buy it. Like I don't buy it.
I disagree with every point that they brought up there. And it is a bit of a relief knowing that it has faced a critical reappraisal.
Yeah,
especially within the last year or two, or particularly during the waning days of the Trump administration, when the movies that people were bringing up, that it's like, oh, here's a movie from a little bit ago that fits this time so much more. The Insider came up right away as one of those of, oh, the insanity of that story and how stressful everything was and the performances in that. I went, oh, that certainly came back, or A Face in the Crowd, that from 1957, that Elia Kazan movie, that came back in a big way. And I don't know that there is going to be a time when someone or popular culture comes back to a point where they go, hey, you know what was a really great time capsule of the late 90s, early 2000s? American Beauty. Because right. if I have kids and they ask what it was like around that time, that is not the movie that I would show anybody. Yeah. Anybody at all. I would dissuade people from watching it.
I wish there were as many people who watched Fight Club and misinterpreted it for what it actually means, who watched American Beauty instead and misinterpreted it for what it actually means.
Yeah, that would have been something. That really would have been something. Where there's plenty, I mean, there's an entire side of fandom of Fight Club that doesn't understand what it was.
Yeah, it doesn't understand that it's a critique of what it's actually saying. And that's the problem with, I think, this is that it's like playing itself off as a critique, but it's not satirical enough. Mm-hmm. It leans too hard on being melodramatic instead of satirical and subtle.
Yeah.
And I think I watched this movie this morning. Like I said, I can recognize that, like, yeah, there are certainly some good parts. I think there's some things that are interesting and unique. But I can see now, like, all right, if I could go back and tell teenage me, like, yeah, don't watch this. Go watch The Insider instead.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, I still haven't seen.
I highly recommend watching The Insider when you get a chance. So,
is
anybody,
that your favorite movie from 99?
I don't know. There were so many that came out that year that I just really, really liked. I haven't watched The Hurricane in a little bit, but I remember really, really liking that. Sixth Sense will always have a special place in my heart for a variety of reasons. One, because I just really liked it. And two, I went, whoa, an Indian American director is actually getting praised for something. This is neat. And then things became far more racist when they talked about him since.
Sixth Sense is still good though. So you got
Sixth Sense is really good. Yeah. I still think of things from Cider House Rules. I think that was this year as well. Where when I look at it, I was like, I thought Haley Joel Osment was going to win Best Supporting Actor that year, and then it went to Michael Caine, which I love Michael Caine, but it felt like, to a degree, one of those later in the career, we're going to make up for not giving you your flowers when we should have awards. Which certainly happened with Scorsese and some others. Or even, was it Alan Arkin for Little Miss Sunshine? He got an Oscar for that. And it felt like they were punishing Eddie Murphy for making Norbit when he was supposed to win for Dreamgirls. It's like his brother wrote the movie and he was doing him a solid. It just happened. It came out in the January before the awards and they went, ugh, maybe.
But Norbit also was nominated for an Academy Award, lest we forget.
Was it for makeup or?
For makeup, something?
Yep. Yep.
Classic horrible movie, but still had like some sort of groundbreaking thing in it. Like Suicide Squad winning for
Academy Award winning Suicide Squad, which, wow. Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot from 99 that I go back and go, this was a really strong year for movies. Fight Club and Magnolia, Bringing Out the Dead.
Ten
Things I Hate About You. That's a better
10 Things I Hate About You
movie.
Is incredible. How did that get nominated for any Oscars?
American Pie, I feel like, has lingered. Any Given Sunday for no other reason than the inches speech that Pacino does. Mm-hmm. That seems to come. The documentary Beyond the Mat that Barry Blaustein made. Bowfinger came out in 99. I saw Bowfinger in a double feature with My Name is Dolomite at the Egyptian. And it was such a good time. And Eddie Murphy was there doing a Q&A with the least gifted interviewer I'd ever met, which one of his questions really felt like, so what's it like to make a movie? How did it feel to make a movie again? What, you, Eddie Murphy, who really doesn't do press and hasn't done it for a long time, your big question is, what was it like making this movie?
Hey, tell me about making a movie.
Yeah. Galaxy Quest came out.
Oh my God, Galaxy Quest in 99. I completely forgot.
Yeah, Galaxy Quest should be in the Criterion Collection. I'm just scanning through a list of movies from 99 that I'm like, better. The Matrix, obviously.
Yeah.
Much better than the thing, The Mummy. The Mummy, I think, has come back that people are really... as part of the Brendan Fraser renaissance that's occurring. Muppets from Space had a lot of fun stuff in it.
Yeah.
Albert Brooks had The Muse. Mystery Men. Office Space. Office Space is probably the one that sticks with me the most as a comedy obsessive. South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Incredible.
Robin Williams doing Blame Canada at the Oscars.
Blame Canada.
Is still
that was a
my
great all-time
probably
Oscar
my
performance.
Favorite Oscar performance ever. Toy Story 2, Virgin Suicides had the soundtrack by Air that was great.
What we're getting at here, folks, is go watch literally any other movie from 1999.
The Wood, which is a nice coming of age romantic comedy buddy movie set in Inglewood. That movie. Still better than that. We just went through and named like 35 movies that are better than this, including The Animaniacs, Wacko's Wish, which is a great Christmas experience to watch.
Well, Rama, I appreciate you cementing the fact that this movie is not worth seeing.
No.
And giving us a great list of recommendations of what they should watch instead. And as far as where you stand, what should people check out that is yours? What have you got going on?
I'm on a lot of animated shows that are out that if you have got small children in your households, you'll like Baby Shark's Big Show and Mirror Royal Detective. I also host the game show Tuned In on Nickelodeon. So if you want an old school Nickelodeon game show where kids get slimed while playing Nicktoon trivia, I am Nikki the Robot on there. I was in the English language dub cast for Squid Game on Netflix. So if you haven't watched Squid Game, go watch Squid Game. It's worth your time in either sub or dub. Watch it however you want. I do not care. Those are all things. And then there's a lot that I'm working on right now, fortunately, but I'm not allowed to talk about any of them. So
that's how it goes.
Yeah, stay tuned. Those are the big things that are happening right now. Tuned In on Nickelodeon, Baby Shark's Big Show on Nickelodeon, Mirror Royal Detective on Disney. And then there's a number of things I've been working on that are coming out in the next year, some of the next couple months. And yeah, go watch Squid Game.
Go, please, if you haven't watched Squid Game, what are you doing? Go watch it. Finish this episode, and it's almost done, and then go watch Squid Game. Get
good
with
idea.
Fucking times, guys.
Yeah.
You can find me at Diet J on Twitter and Instagram, jlightcomedy.com for show dates, and if you like the podcast, consider subscribing to the Patreon. You get bonus episodes, access to my film library, all sorts of fun stuff there. Rama, thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me, Jay.
Of course. This has been Blockbusting. Go see something good for a change.